Heidi had the He-Man task of putting together the bulletin thing and getting everything typed up and wrestling with the printing machines downstairs. And then in listing all the people that helped, she left herself off the back of the bulletin. I became to realize afterwards that I made a big mistake, that the whole meal was not supposed to be for everybody. I was treating it like a fellowship dinner, you know. Everybody is welcome to come. Supposed to be just for the family, I guess. But it turns out that food lasted pretty well. Everybody seemed to, I told my wife, nobody seemed to complain. Not sure if you would complain at a funeral, but where's the food? But I thought it went really well. And Jerry's right. When you speak at a funeral, it's not going to do anybody any good if you just stand up in front and blubber. And it'll be easy to let go. There's some sort of a psychological thing that you do. You take a step back. You remove yourself out of that, and now it's just focused on the people you're talking to, not about you. So I don't know how to explain that, but something you can do if you understand the importance of what you're dealing with. Marriage Seminar, Biblical Secrets of Intimacy, Lesson 8, Session 3, Getting Through. Getting Through. We'll be looking today at the perils to avoid. The objective here is to achieve a proper balance between expressing desires and expressing love. Desire is what you want. Love is what they need, what you see they desire. The scriptural key, 1 Corinthians 13:7, charity, love, beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. Getting through. Getting through. The perils to avoid, first of all, on the one side, denying love, on the second, destroying love. Now, denying love, we see the example of this in Revelation 3:17. Christ, writing the letter through John to the church at Laodicea, says, "Because thou sayest, I am rich, and increased with goods, and have need of nothing." This is that independent spirit that says, I don't have need of anything. So, God, you can just, you know, just watch as I do what I do. Don't worry about it. Husband, wife, you know, I don't really need you. I have need of nothing. I'm sufficient in myself. And he says, you say this out of ignorance. You knowest not that thou art wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. And from his point of view, he saw what they really were. Here they are standing there like a greasy homeless person saying, I've got everything I need. I'm rich, increased with goods, have need of nothing. He says, all the important stuff you're missing. So when we fail to express our needs and desires to our mate, we soon lose our sense of dependence on our partner, and love is lost. To a great degree, love really shows and is ready to show that dependence. The husband looks to his wife to fulfill her role as a completer. The wife looks to her husband to fulfill his role as guide and protector. And as we become independent of each other, love loses its enthusiasm. Love is not essentially an emotion, although loving emotion should accompany love. Love is meeting the needs of the loved object with no thought of repayment. John 3:16 illustrates the definition of love. God so loved the world that he gave He gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. He loved, and so he gave. He loved, he saw the need, he gave to meet that need. So real love is not only felt, it is also demonstrated. We deny the function of love if we do not express our needs and desires. It is not wrong to dream together of seemingly unreachable goals as long as we avoid covetousness. Do you know what I would like sometime? Can't happen now. We don't have the money, you know. But it's a little dream. My wife and I, years ago, one of the things we'd do, when we did this while we were dating. Can't do it so much anymore. Nice neighborhoods, they don't let you walk through there anymore. But we would go to a place and drop the car off and just walk through and look at the beautiful homes and so on. You protect yourself by saying, you know, this isn't lusting after it and all of that. It's just, you're just dreaming ahead. So nothing wrong with that. So the idea of interdependence, saying I have needs and I'm counting on you to meet that. The opposite of this is expecting, having expectations of the other one, and especially unspoken expectations. Well, I just expect her to do these things. That means that if she does it, you don't give her any thanks because you just expected it. See? and if she doesn't do it, even though you didn't tell her to do it, then she's in trouble. And the other way around. Husband's always in trouble if he doesn't do what the wife expected him to do, though he didn't know that was what she was expecting him to do. Expectation dries up a loving desire. I remember hearing about my mother's parents, and my grandfather was a guy who, I'm sure he had all his faults, but he was a guy who just could do anything, fix anything. He'd worked as on the railroad, worked on the farm, you know, times were tough. He fixed anything that needed fixed, he fixed it. And so all around the little town, Rochester, Indiana, he was the go-to guy, you know. And so if the widow called, his faucet was having a problem, he'd go fix it. And she paid him lavishly. She didn't have any money, but she said, "Oh, you are so kind to me. How lucky your wife is to have a man like you." You know, and you know, he had to get out of there before he swelled up and popped. Then he'd go home, and Grandma would say, "So you're out fixing everybody else's faucet, and this thing's been leaking for the last, you know." So he'd finally get it done, and her reward would be, "It's about time." So it wasn't too shocking that he left a lot of those things undone and went to where he was getting paid more. One of those things where expectations, the unspoken expectations, dries things up. But spoken desires give, I told my wife a number of times that I always want to be her knight in shining armor. I want to be the guy who comes riding in, saves the day. I'll do whatever it takes to do that, see. But for that to happen, she needs to say, "Help! Help me! I'm in trouble, I need your help." And then that allows me to be the helper. So this whole thing of denying love is denying your needs and wants. Then a second area, the opposite of this, is destroying love. We're going to go into some detail in this by a word study here, but when desires are expressed without phrasing them in words and attitudes of love, then love is destroyed. A destroyed love may be rebuilt, but much damage has occurred unnecessarily. Even the simplest of desires may cause serious damage if the attitude expressed wrong motives. We excuse harsh railing against the other by calling it reproof. In the back of the page there, we have the root meaning of reproving versus the root meaning of reviling, and then a contrast between them two, between the two. Let's take a look at that. Scripture associates exhorting with the act of reproving or rebuking an offending brother. To reprove is basically saying you ought not to have done that. Here are the words. 1 Timothy 5:1, rebuke not an elder, but entreat him as a father, and the younger men as brethren. Then 2 Timothy 4:2, preach the word, be instant in season, out of season. Reprove, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and doctrine. This is getting people to do the right thing. Titus 2:5, these things speak and exhort and rebuke with all authority. Let no man despise thee. This to pastors of churches. And then Hebrews 12:5, have you forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as children? My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. So together these three words, these three English words, provide the necessary balance to approach a brother who needs correction, a brother or mate. Reprove, the word elekho, means to tell someone his fault, to admonish, to convince someone of his error, to give evidence, to convict, bring them under conviction. Compared to other synonyms, it means to rebuke with sufficient cause and also effectually, so as to bring the one rebuked to a confession or at least a conviction of sin. In other words, it means to convince. The word rebuke is the Greek word epitemao. It means to command, to charge, lay a charge on someone, to order, to admonish. Compared to other synonyms, it means simply to rebuke in any sense. It may be just or unjust, and if just, the rebuke may be heeded or it may not. And then exhort, this is para kaleo, to call alongside, to help. It means to beg, to urge, to encourage, to request, to ask, to appeal to console, to comfort, to cheer up, to call to one side, and urge to pursue a course of action. So it can be to encourage, it can be to exhort, it can be to comfort. So the root meaning of reviling now is a sin, and the root meaning of the following three Greek words describe the scope and action of the sin of reviling or railing. Revile, we see the word onaidizo. It means to reproach, to denounce, to insult, to taunt, to chide. You see, it's an attitude shift. May refer to deserved reproach or undeserved reproach, but in either way, it's not the way to bring that reproach. The second word is loidoreo. It means to reproach, rail at, heap abuse on. There's no encouragement in this, you see. And these are translated revile. And then the word rail is the word blasphemeo. This is the word blaspheme. If you do it against God, this is blasphemy. You do it against men, it's railing. It means to speak reproachfully, to revile, to calumniate, put evil, say evil upon them, to blaspheme. So, reproving versus reviling. Let's think of that, about the difference. Reproving, one who reproves or rebukes, has the basic objective of restoring an offender through exhortation. Certainly this would be the case in the home. You see something that has been done wrong, you approach it to restore them to proper, restore them into proper form. 2 Timothy 4:2, preach the word, be instant in season, exhort with all longsuffering and doctrine. This witness is true, wherefore rebuke them sharply that they may be sound. In other words, they may be corrected. And Titus 2:15, these things speak and exhort, rebuke with all authority, let no man despise thee. So the basic idea of restoring, getting them in proper working order. Number two, one who reproves or rebukes combines love and truth when correcting a brother. Truth without love is harshness. Love, so-called love, without truth is just compromise. In Luke 17:3, take heed to yourselves. If thy brother trespass against thee, rebuke him, and if he repent, forgive him. And it is this mixture of love and truth that makes a proper concept of proper reproving. 1 Timothy 5:20, them that sin rebuke before all, that others may also may fear. And a third thought is that one who reproves or rebukes is aware of certain limitations. There are certain things you just don't go beyond that in reproving. 1 Timothy 5:1, rebuke not an elder, the older man. See, you just don't do that. I was reminded of that thinking of President Dennis, because back when there was this whole build-up of trying to build up a case and turn everybody against the administration back at the old property, one of the things that would happen is the two of the oldest men in the school that he had been faithful to talk to the trustees and so on about making sure they were being well cared for and so on, they would come in and just rake him over the coals and yell and scream and do all of these things. And he would just sit there and take it and kind of say, you know, I'll work on that, thank you. And, you know, that was about it. But he never would raise his voice against these people. And getting his side of the story, he said, you know, he says, I'm not going to say bad things to an older person. It's just, he just set it down as a principle of life. So there are certain things where you just don't do that. Rebuke not an elder, but entreat him as a father. How would you go to your father, the person who did so much for you, you know, and try to get him to change? How would you do that? Entirely different attitude than just beating him down. And the younger men as brethren. Sometimes you have an age difference where the younger person can be destroyed by you, the authority, the older person, just beating him up with your words. Think of him as a brother. How would you deal with your brother? Jude 9, yet Michael the archangel, when contending with the devil himself, he disputed about the body of Moses, durst not bring against him a railing accusation. He wouldn't even do that to the devil. He said, the Lord rebuke thee. Now that's reproving, you see. Notice the contrast then between that and reviling. Reviling, one who reviles or rails has the basic objective of exposing one whom he has already judged. I have judged that you are wrong. I want to expose you to the world. Mark 15:29, they that passed by railed on him. This is Jesus Christ hanging on the cross. They're railing on him, wagging their head, saying, ah, thou that destroyest the temple and buildest in 3 days, you know, mocking. We see how powerful you are now, hanging there in your own blood. Luke 23:39, one of the malefactors that were hanged railed on him, saying, if thou be Christ, save thyself and us. So, already judged, now exposing it to everybody else, doing it out loud, wherever the people can hear, especially. Number two, one who reviles or rails disclaims any further responsibility for or association with the one who may judge. I strike you, I throw the black paint on you, and then I walk away. You know, John 9:28, then they reviled him and said, thou art his disciple, but we are Moses' disciples. Turn away from him. One who reviles or rails recognizes no restrictions on his efforts to vilify or defame. Matthew 5:11, blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Here's the definition of railing from the person that's receiving it. See? In 1 Timothy 6:4, he is proud, knowing nothing, but doting about questions and strifes of words, whereof cometh envy, strife, railings, evil surmising. So the source of it is not love mingled with truth, but pride, ignorance, and doting about unimportant questions and strifes of words. All right. If I have done my job, I've given you an inner sense of the difference between reproving, which is to restore and is done with love and recognizes limitations, and reviling, which is done in judgment with no sense of limitation and no love. Looking then back at the first page, I ended with, we excuse harsh railing against the other by calling it reproof. So, as you come to the place where something needs to be said, somebody has done something wrong, think about it before you speak. It's always the key. Think about it before you speak. You just don't rush out with the emotion of speaking. You think about it before you speak, and you recognize that the goal is getting them back on track. So love wants to do that, and you're going to be limited in what you're going to say by being careful about that. So you will then reprove without railing. The next paragraph says, when you assume your mate has a wrong attitude or motive, you have already committed an unloving act. Real love gives the benefit of a doubt. Story I've told concerning this a number of times, so I'm sure some of you remember, is a couple that came to me with a need for marriage counseling. Both of them good Christian people. We had known them for a long time. I remember they came in, we had a real long couch at the time, and they sat at opposite ends of the couch. And the story was that after church on Sunday night, he came out and his brother was in town, hadn't been in town for a while. So he said to his wife, I'm going to go drop you off, then I'm going to stop by my brother. And so she just looked at him. She said, well, when are you going to be home? Well, that's all it took. He saw that she wanted to rule his life, be his mother. And he said, I'll be home whenever I feel like getting home. And he had the car door open for her. She just sat down, wouldn't get in the car. And now he sees that she's, you know, trying to strong arm him to obey her. And so he's getting really steamed, and he says, get your legs in the car. She just sat there. He said, I'm going to close the door. She just sat there. So he swung the car door, bounced it off her shins. She said she felt that if he did it again, it'd break her legs. So she put the legs in, and he slammed the door closed. Cool went to cold on the way home. He dropped her off. He left, took his own sweet time in getting back. But they couldn't get past that. So they came to me. So, you know, this didn't sound like them at all. So I said to her, I said, when you said, what time will you be home, did you say that because you wanted to control him. You thought it was your right to tell him what to do. She says, no, of course not. You know, like, what a silly thought. Which is, of course, exactly what he thought. She said, no, I know that when he gets with his brother, time just flies. He'll be out late. They were living in an apartment building at the time. We've had break-ins at the apartment. And I didn't want to be left all night alone with that threat. In other words, she was looking for a knight in shining armor to come help her. But she didn't say, well, honey, you know how it is with you and your brother, how long you spend, and we've been having that problems at the apartment. I don't want to be out too late. And I'll tell you, he would have, you know, broken his legs to get there to help her. So she explains this, and from the other end of that long couch, he turns and he says, no, you didn't. He couldn't let that be the case. He's breaking her legs because, she was sitting there because she felt abandoned, not because she was muscling in to be the authority. That changed everything. I said to him, if you had known that was her concern, would you have said, I'll just do whatever I want? He said, no, of course not. He said, I would never have left her alone if I thought she was afraid. But he said, he didn't think that the problem was very, very much. But the fact that she did would have changed everything. And so by the end, they had moved together on the couch and apologized. And the thought came to me, this very thought, real love gives the benefit of a doubt. Right there at the point when she said, what time are you going to be home? He could have gotten through that and said, well, why do you ask? And then it would have come out, maybe peevishly and so on, but it would have come out. Job, when his wife says, curse God and die, says, that doesn't sound like you. See? When he says, I'm going to go visit my brother, how easy it would have been for her to say what was really on her heart. Instead of saying, well, I know you have no control. You just stay out, have fun, and you leave me all alone. She assumed that, see, without assuming that if she said, I'll be afraid at home, expressing her needs, her desire, that he would want to respond to that. Fairness demands that before we put the worst possible interpretation on what someone says or does, we ought to do some checking. We ought to ask some questions. Perhaps if we do not like what someone said, we ought to assume that we have misinterpreted him. For example, if a husband says to the wife, I want you to know I'm praying for you, she should not respond by thinking, I wonder what he thinks is wrong with me now. He's never satisfied. He's always trying to change me. Rather, she should assume he must really be concerned about me. He knows my trials and fears and wants God to strengthen me. That man really loves me. Love gives the benefit of the doubt. If a wife says to her husband, I thought you would never come home, it would be wrong for him to think, there she goes complaining again. I can't do anything right. She wants to run my life. Instead, he should assume she means, I really missed you. I love you so much, I can hardly wait for you to come home. How different those things sound, don't they? And yet, love should give the benefit of a doubt. And in fact, even if things are said in an improper way, if a loving response comes back to that, those things heal so, so very quickly. Inherent in the whole communication listening dynamic is the necessity to try to see things from the other person's point of view. To see things from the other person's perspective may require repeating what he said back to him until he is satisfied that you understand. It may involve asking him kindly to say it in a different or amplified way until you are sure you understand. Let's turn to page 3 there and look at the root meaning of discernment. The root meaning of discernment. Following 3 Greek words describe the scope and action of discernment. The first one is dokimazo. It means to test. It's the word that if I brought you a gold ore to put under the testing thing, this was the word that you would use. To test, to examine, to interpret, to discover, to approve, to prove, to demonstrate, to recognize as genuine after examination. This is then discernment, putting it to the test, seeing if it's real. Number 2 is anakrino. Krino is to judge. Anakrino is to judge up or again. It means to examine, to judge, to investigate, to examine, to inquire into. I have examined in there twice, don't I? To scrutinize, to shift, to question, to determine the excellence or defects of any person or thing. And the third one is diakrino. It means to separate, to make a distinction, to discriminate, to prefer. So discernment is about actually analyzing, actually making some distinctions, you see. The root meaning of judgment as a different thing. Primarily the word krino means to pass judgment on, to sentence, to mentally or judicially condemn, to conclude, to decide, to determine. You hear the finality in all of that. Discernment versus judgment. Discernment, one who discerns thoroughly, examines himself before evaluating the actions of others. Please understand that a great deal of your perception is colored by who you are and how you're thinking. I trick myself all the time because I think something is something, and that's what I see. My wife complaining that she goes to the store, she sees the shampoo, and she sees the conditioner. She wants the shampoo, so she puts the conditioner in there and buys it and takes it home. This isn't shampoo. And the thing is that depending on where she put it or where she thought it was, when she picked it up, her mind said, that's the shampoo. It's just odd because this is the way we think. We think, and that colors the way we act. Notice these scriptures. 1 Corinthians 11, 28 and 31. But let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of that bread and drink of that cup. For if we would judge ourselves, we should not be judged. 2 Corinthians 13, 5. Examining yourselves, whether you be in the faith. Prove your own selves. Know not your own selves, the how that Jesus Christ is in you, except you be reprobates. So Christ is in you if you're really saved. So we examine ourselves, Galatians 6, 4, but let every man prove his own work, and then shall he have rejoicing in himself alone and not in another. This is that proper pride of your own work, that you're proud of what you've done. So one who discerns thoroughly examines himself before evaluating the actions of others. Am I coming to this trying to discern or just trying to judge? Then secondly, one who discerns checks the accuracy of all the facts and related factors before reaching a conclusion. 1 Corinthians 2:15, but he that is spiritual judgeth, this is the weighing of things, all things, yet he himself is judged of no man. 1 Thessalonians 5:21, prove, put to the test, all things, hold fast that which is good. 1 John 4:1, brethren, beloved, believe not every spirit. These are when the people were saying, I have a word from the Spirit, a word of prophecy to tell. He says, believe not every spirit, but try, put to the test the spirits, whether they are of God, because many false prophets are gone out into the world. And then the third distinction of discernment is one who discerns deals as privately as possible with the problems he sees. 1 Corinthians 6, 5 and 6, I speak to your shame. Is it so that there is not a wise man among you? No, not one that shall be able to judge between his brethren? But brother goeth to law with brother, and that before the unbelievers? When Matthew 18, when Christ told go deal with people, he says, first of all, just go yourself. If you can get this settled between just two of you, that's the best. But if you can't, then bring two or three people with you, one or two, so that in counting you, two or three witnesses, all is confirmed. So it's not just your word against his. You bring somebody in and deal with it this way. Then if they reject that, you tell it to the church. And so one of the motives of getting things right is that the circle of people who know about this problem is getting bigger and bigger. If you tell everybody first, you give them no motive to get it settled. So trying to deal with this privately as possible. Compare this to judgment. One who judges condemns others for their visible problems, but fails to realize that their attitudes stem from root problems that he himself has not yet overcome. You and I will have a very different attitude towards somebody with a problem if we have had the same basic root problems and overcome them by God's help. If God's grace has helped us get over a problem, we will deal with them with sympathy and encouragement. Proper reproof, but with encouragement. If we have failed in that root sin, we have nothing to offer them. And what comes out is a condemning spirit. Romans 2:1, therefore thou art inexcusable, O man, whosoever thou art that judgest. For wherein thou judgest another, thou condemnest thyself, for thou that judgest dost the same things. Romans 14:10, why dost thou judge thy brother? Why dost thou set at naught thy brother? For we all shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. You're fellow workers. You're not the judge. You're fellow workers, you see. So the attitude of judgment shows a similar problem. Number two, one who judges forms opinion on first impressions or hearsay, then looks for evidence to confirm his opinions, even though the evidence may be out of context. John 7, 24 and 51, judge not according to the appearance, but judge righteous judgment. Doth our law judge any man before it hear him and know what he doth? Proper judgment doesn't do that. James 4:11, speak not evil one of another, brethren. He that speaketh evil of his brother and judgeth his brother speaketh evil of the law and judgeth the law. But if thou judge the law, there are not a doer of the law, but a judge. Again, you know, who made you to be the judge? Does not the law say that God is the judge? And then three, one who judges publicly exposes those he condemns. This may cause others to condemn him for having the same root problem. Luke 6:37, judge not, and ye shall not be judged. Condemn not, ye shall not be condemned. Forgive, and ye shall be forgiven. So again, this idea of discernment, trying to see what's going on in a person's life, means some actual investigation, putting aside preconceived notions. My mother had this ability, some sort of a file system in her brain, that if I was one of the dishwashers, three boys in the house, we didn't have a mechanical dishwasher, I was the dishwasher. And then as my brothers got older, they did the drying, I did the washing. I started out doing the drying as my mom did the washing, but then it became my job. And so over a period of time, I would drop and break a dish or a glass or a bowl, and they would be at various rank of her favorite piece of china or something, you know. And I know that it happened more than once, but it did not happen every time I touched the dishes. Pretty sure of that. And the thing is that any time I would drop and break it, then all the times that I ever did that, those file cards would pop up. This was before computers. Those file cards would pop up in my mom's brain. So all she's looking at is five times that I touched the dishes and I broke it. And so she'd say, "You're always breaking those dishes." And I knew I wasn't always breaking because we still had dishes. You know? And then I would feel abused, you know. And I'm just trying to help, you know. And so the thing is, analyze your perceptions and then approach it. This is discernment, keeping self out of it. Be properly analytical and then avoid this thing of judgment. Make it clear in your own thinking that God is the one who will judge. We are just people working together in life, in church, and in the home. Comments or questions? Getting through. Love giving the benefit of a doubt. All right. Thank you. Let's stand together. We'll be dismissed in prayer. Father, we thank you that you give us these things to consider, the ins and outs of personal relationship, the concept of reproving versus railing, of discernment versus judgment. Help us to approach then with a proper attitude these things, especially in our home. Help us as husbands and wives to be very clear that we can share our needs and allow love to come to the rescue. And we will approach our mate on the basis of giving them the benefit of the doubt. We will assume that they have the best of intentions, even if they're not at this very moment expressing it very well. So guide and direct us then. We turn our hearts over to you, turn our families, our marriages over to you, and we pray it in Jesus' name.